This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I also believe that teacher evaluations should be multidimensional, just as your evaluation, Mike, shouldn't be based solely on how many people listen to this podcast.
Thank goodness for that.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the original Education Gadfly and the Karen Lewis of the education reform world, Checker Finn.
I'm not that fat.
Okay, we get started right away. Hey, I think this is fair game because she made fun of Arne Duncan's lisp. I think anything is on the table.
She is unattractive in so many ways.
You know, she is bombastic, though. Some might say a gadfly, as you've been known to be yourself.
Yeah, and she's been obviously trying to win her points in Chicago. It's also obvious that she and Rahm Emanuel really dislike each other intensely. I don't think that helps the negotiation process.
All right. Well, maybe they'll be seeing Kumbaya shortly. We are taping this on Tuesday. We're not quite sure yet whether the unions are going to agree to the latest deal, but we're pretty sure that they are. We're going to talk about that and many other things to come. Let's start by playing Pardon the Gadfly.
Now that the Chicago teacher strike is wrapping up, what are the national implications of the settlement?
It's going to be bad and good. It is bad because it shows that in the country's third largest city, the teachers have managed to evade some things they needed to accept, like rigorous achievement-based evaluations and longer working days so that kids can learn more and things like that. It is good over the long run for education reformers because it really does illustrate what the unions are about, which is the grown-ups, not the kids. And I think it's very important. I think public opinion in Chicago is already shifting from blaming the mayor for the strike to blaming the union for the strike the second week. And I think what the unions exist to do is being made utterly transparent now. It has nothing to do with kids learning.
You know, this is something that we've been predicting all along, was that this was going to play badly nationally. Certainly, the original coverage was quite negative. You have even the New York Times editorial board writing two, maybe three now, editorials really attacking the unions for being unreasonable. But, Checker, don't you think at the same time, teachers around the country say, hey, finally somebody stood up to these reformers and they were able to push them back? You don't think that's going to embolden teacher unions in other places?
I think it will, but I think it will embolden the reformers and the management, let's call it, to push even harder and say we are not going to let happen in XYZville what happened in Chicago.
Okay, topic number two.
How to evaluate teachers fairly was a key issue in the Chicago strike. Should evaluations incorporate outside inspectors as well as student performance?
The more things, the better in evaluating teachers, because teaching is a complicated art and craft and science, and it shouldn't be based on any one thing. It shouldn't be just based on the principal's observation. It shouldn't just be based on the kids' test scores. It shouldn't just be based on outside visitors who know what they're looking for coming in and looking for it. It needs to be all of the above and some more besides.
You know, Kathleen Porter-McGee on our team wrote a great post talking about the Chicago evaluation. It was quite good. The system was very good. It was developed with lots of educator input. They were using, instead of the state assessment, which has all kinds of problems, they were using the Northwest Evaluation Association assessment, which allows you to pinpoint exactly where a kid is because the assessment's computer adaptive, and then show how much progress they made over the course of the year. These test scores, you know, now are going to account for something like 30% plus some student surveys. I mean, these are good evaluation systems that are being put in place, and yet, you know, you have the union saying at least that they went on strike because they didn't like the use of student test scores. Look, student test scores are going to be in there no matter what. This strike wasn't about evaluations. It wasn't about use of student test scores. It was about power, and it was about job security, right? I mean, at the end of the day, everybody knows there's going to be a bunch of schools closed down in Chicago, and the question is, do those teachers get to keep their jobs or not?
Agreed. But I also believe that teacher evaluations should be multidimensional, just as your evaluation, Mike, shouldn't be based solely on how many people listen to this podcast.
Thank goodness for that. Okay, topic number three.
Checker, first it was New York's prestigious Stuyvesant High School that endured a cheating scandal. Now it's your alma mater, Harvard. Are students at these highly selective schools more prone to academic dishonesty, and what can be done to prevent it?
What can be done to prevent it is a hard question, because the technology that encourages or facilitates cheating gets easier and better all the time. And I don't know whether the preventers can stay one step ahead of the technology with things like submit your essay to some website that reviews to see whether it's got plagiarized material in it. What you find in these highly competitive, highly selective institutions are highly competitive people. And highly competitive people are trying very hard to get ahead, however it takes, whatever it takes. They have very sharp elbows, that includes cutting corners. Just because you're smart doesn't mean you have integrity. I think that the more competitive you are, the likelier you are to cut corners. And that includes, unfortunately, cheating on tests and essays and all sorts of other things. I'll repeat, Stuyvesant doesn't have gang warfare. I mean, there are a lot of discipline advantages at places like Stuyvesant. You don't have rumbling in the halls and people bringing knives to schools. Their big discipline problem is indeed academic integrity. And how to enforce that, aside from setting a good signal about the code of ethics and good role models and things like that, which is important, is to foil the cheaters.
So, Checker, you just came out with a book called Exam Schools on schools like Stuyvesant and others. And in it, you say that Stuyvesant really is unusual, as are some of these other New York City schools, in that they just use the exam for admissions. Most other places have more of a college-style admissions process where they can look at recommendations in a broader look. I mean, is that part of the issue? It happened at Stuyvesant because Stuyvesant only looks at test scores and doesn't get a fuller picture of the kids coming in, that maybe other schools around the country are better at catching people that might have questionable character?
That's a really interesting possibility. There's only a small number of the so-called exam schools that rely entirely on exams for admissions purposes. There's 9 in New York. I believe there's 3 in Boston. There's just a few everywhere else. Much more common in these selective admission schools is a kind of holistic college admissions office type of review, which includes teacher recommendations and student essays and grades and a variety of other things. So in the other places where there's a holistic review, it's a whole lot easier to ask those writing the recommendations for an applicant to say, does this person have integrity? Can you trust this person? Any disciplinary infractions? Stuyvesant really does just look at a single test score for getting in, and it has no way of screening for things like integrity.
To what extent do the exam schools teach character?
Truthfully, I don't know. You don't see it in their curriculum as a separate course. What you hope for and do see are teachers and mentors in the larger world, in labs and businesses and universities and things like that, setting a good example. So I hope that they are imparting character to their students by example and by real-world type situations. But if you look down their curriculum, I don't believe you'll find a values and ethics course or a character course. You might well find a philosophy course, however.
All right, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike. May I just say I like your cologne today? Is this a new cologne you're
thank
wearing?
You. I didn't know that you could smell it.
Yes,
really.
It's really nice. Is it new?
It's newish. I mean, it means that I did not ride my bike in today. It means that I took the metro. I could put the cologne on. And by the way, my 2-year-old son, Leandro, very much likes me putting cologne on him, too.
Yes.
When he sees me putting it on, he wants me to spray it.
Yes.
Him. So I do.
It's a nice cologne scent. Anyway.
You know, because if little girls can wear earrings, then little boys can wear cologne.
This
That's my
true.
Attitude. So last time you were here, you were not feeling so kind towards the Chicago Teachers Union.
I was not.
Have your feelings changed at all?
No, they have not.
As we talked earlier, looks like ROM got rolled.
Yeah, depressing. I mean, it's just depressing. I have a hard time really even reading it and getting into the details because it's, I don't know why. Why do I take these things personally? It's just silly. But
well, because this
know,
is your life's just, work, Amber.
Yeah,
that's
you get
why.
Passionate about it and you feel like you're fighting the good fight and then you read this stuff and you're like, ugh, you just
but
feel deflated.
What I want to know is that you were getting a lot of comments on Facebook. Do you have a sense, are your teacher friends, do they feel empowered by this? Are they happy or not?
I feel like my teacher friends feel like they work long hours, and actually a lot of them were kind of upset when they heard of this 5.5 hour contract day that they used to have, you know, and they're like, look, that's crazy. I spend, you know, twice that when I get home. And sure, I did the same thing as teachers. So I think that they feel like they work hard already. And for these teachers to try to be wanting more and more, even when they've already got a pretty generous contract, they felt that it was a little unfair.
Okay. Well, We will now turn the page.
Turn the page.
Put on, you know, take off your analyst hat and put on your researcher hat. What do you got for us this week?
We got new NAEP writing results. So this is kind of interesting because it's the first time that NAEP writing has been administered via the computer. So last year, the NAGBE board approved the digital version of the test last year. So we've got a new test, new scales, so we can't compare results to prior versions. So about 24,000 eighth graders and 24,000 12th graders engaged in various writing tasks, both academic and workplace oriented, on the computer. They were also allowed to use common word processing tools like a thesaurus and spell check and cut and paste and all that stuff. Bottom line, almost a quarter of students at both grades 8 and 12 performed at the proficient level. Roughly 50% of both grades performed at the basic level. A little less than a quarter scored below basic, and 3% at both levels performed at advanced. So, you know, we're kind of getting used to this in terms of what these scores look like. In general, girls scored higher than boys. Asians and whites scored higher than Latino and African Americans. Descriptive survey findings, so they asked the kids a bunch of questions. Students without word processing access outside of school scored lower than those with it. Makes sense. Average public school student had a score of 16 points lower than the private school kids and 18 points lower than the kids at Catholic schools. And then I started digging into the back of it. The thesaurus evidently proved to be a great tool because students who used it scored higher on average than students who didn't, and those who used it repeatedly scored higher than those who used it just once. 80% of eighth graders did not use the cut, copy, and paste feature, though, which I thought was a little strange. I use it all the time.
Yes, indeed.
74% use spell check. Roughly a third of eighth graders use bold and italics. And nearly half use the highlighter, which makes you think, are they just kind of playing around here?
The highlighter?
The highlighter.
Did they use too many exclamation points?
I don't think that was captured. Anyway, final gripe. Then I started digging into what the prompts were, because, you know, I used to teach English. These prompts drive me crazy. Pretend you were lost on an island. What do you see and hear was the prompt that some of these kids got.
Content free.
Woo, content free. If we have a minute, can I just share a couple little sections of what this is kind
sure,
of
sure, sure, sure. We'll go for the research 2 minutes.
Two minutes. You're developing, right? This is the developing score. The reason we were on this island is because our plane crashed. We drifted here. There's a total of 10 people on the plane. Nobody died, thanks to the pilot. We're college students on a vacation to Hawaii. All of a sudden, we were attacked by monkeys. So we ran back and squeezed on the plane until the ferocious monkeys left.
Now, that was, what kind of score was that?
That's
last
developing.
One? That means below basic?
That means below basic.
For 12th
right.
graders?
Developing that, I think that's 8th grade, actually.
Wow, I thought the ferocious monkey part was pretty good.
This is adequate. Now, tell me you don't think the thesaurus is coming in handy here, okay?
Here we go.
The animal looked like a brontosaurus, bigger and more muscular. There were many more animals on the island also. Another animal looked like a rhinoceros. Spell check, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
But it had four eyes and big horns. When we made it to the apex of the mountain, ooh, apex, word choice, the scenery was truly magnificent.
Mm.
So I don't know. Part of me is actually wondering, Mike, like, are you getting higher scores because you're using spell check and thesaurus?
And 25-cent words.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, so like, this is something we need to wrestle with, right? With new digitally computer-based exams, is where does it become more of the advantages of the tool versus what the child knows? And do we not care about that because in the adult working world, we all have a computer and get to use these things anyway?
Right. This is the calculator question. Do we really care? And I think this is the question I think comes down on calculators. The argument is you let kids use calculators too early. They don't learn the math by heart, and that does hurt them later on. And there's pretty good evidence on that. I guess we have to find out on things like spell check and thesaurus, you know, use. Does that end up hurting your fluency in writing in some way in another time?
Right.
You would think that it could. Did they, in the back where they asked background questions, did they ask anything about students writing? Like, do they text message a lot? Do they write for fun?
If they did, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
I want to know, do kids who have blogs write better than kids who don't?
Okay. I think there was a blog thing in here. I'd have to go back. back, but I do remember something to that effect.
All right. Yeah. One last thing, Amber. You didn't mention it, but at the eighth grade level, twice as many girls as boys scored proficient. You did say there was a gender gap. Okay, twice as many. So what's your take? I mean, there's been a lot of debate in recent years. Sarah Mead's been in the middle of this on whether there is a boys crisis. I guess this writing is basically the worst subject for boys.
Yeah. Always,
how big a deal is this?
Always has been. I mean, I know when I was in the classroom, it was the same thing. Girls just seem to be able to unleash, especially in narrative writing. They just, not that boys weren't as imaginative, but they just seem to be able to express their ideas in writing better. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, right. Well, this was an interesting question. I mean, okay, this is going to, I got to be careful here on these gender stereotypes here. Okay. But you said they can express themselves better in writing. Right. I would think that girls in general express themselves more in speaking too.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's just a more part of the culture is girls talking about their feelings to each other or telling each other stories. You see this anywhere you go.
There's
just, you know, so maybe that translates into being able to put a pen to paper as well.
That's right. It's still the men are from Mars, women are from Venus thing too, right? Like everybody's, you know, if you ask a man a question, give him some time to think about it. Let him go to his cave and then come back and he can. So you get all this psychology too. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But there's something there.
Thanks as always, Amber. Fascinating stuff.
You're welcome.
Till next week.
I'm Checker Finn.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.